You're listening to highlights from One Planet Podcast's interview with Dana Fisher, author of Saving Ourselves, From Climate Shocks to Climate Action. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
I call myself an apocalyptic optimist. In other words, I do believe that there is hope to save ourselves from the climate crisis that we have all caused. However, I also believe that saving ourselves will only be possible with a mass mobilization that is driven by the pain and suffering of climate shocks around the world. A generalized sense of extreme risk can lead to peaceful and less peaceful mass mobilizations at the levels needed to stimulate an anthroshift. Only a global risk event, or numerous smaller ones that are seen as threatening social and economic centers of power, will motivate the kind of massive and social change that is needed. In other words, without a risk, be it driven by social or environmental change, an anthroshift that is large enough to respond adequately to the climate crisis and open a large enough window of opportunity post-shock is improbable. At this point, it is impossible to predict if such a shock will come from ecological disaster, war, pandemic, or another unforeseen risk. What is certain, though, is that without such a shock that motivates an anthroshift large enough to reorient all the actors of society to respond meaningfully to the climate crisis, it is hard to envision the world achieving the levels of climate action needed. Instead, the best we can hope for is incremental change that does not disrupt the dominant nodes of political and economic power. Such incremental change has the potential to reduce the gravity of the crisis, but it will not stop the coming climate crisis. I think one of the things that I've had a lot of conversations as I was on book tour with different scholars, and there's this window where people will feel like they still can make a difference. One of the things that I've been talking a lot about is that the research I've done on climate activists recently is that for people who are engaged in climate activism, they're really experiencing the climate crisis firsthand and feeling anger about it. And anger is a wonderful motivator. It is true that at a certain point, things will get so bad that people may very well freeze or may become extremely tribal and mostly focused on saving themselves and their individual families rather than the broader work of saving ourselves, which is needed. I think that the moment for us to save ourselves is coming up, and it's coming soon. If we wait too long, things could get so bad that at least in certain parts of the world, it'll just be too late. I was living in New York City when 9/11 happened, and one of the things that we were all very worried about, and right in the beginning, when right after the first plane hit, I lived uptown because I was teaching at Columbia University, so I thought we really should go out and buy water because, you know, a disaster's coming. What are you going to do? You buy water. We were just like, we got to go and buy some canned goods and water just in case the world is about to end. So we went out, and on our way to the supermarket right around in our neighborhood, these other people saw us carrying gallons of water out and taking them home, and they said, don't take them all. And I thought, oh my gosh, we could end up in this really scary world that's a really apocalyptic, horrible place where people are fighting one another. But that's not what happened at all. When the day was over and the buildings had both fallen down and a whole section of the city was basically closed down and people were unhoused, and I had students who had been lost. Thankfully, I didn't have any students who perished that day, but some of them had gotten trapped because they stopped all trains. You couldn't come in or out of Manhattan. And by that night, people had posted pictures of loved ones who were missing, and they were candles that people had put on the street corners that they had burning at all times in memory of the people who had lost and those who had fallen. And it was beautiful the way that the community, a community that was really quite atomized. I mean, in New York City, it's not known for being a very embedded and tight community of neighbors, right? But people came out and were supporting one another in such a beautiful way. And I think that that's what we can see. And there are stories like that after other disasters as well. And so we need to take hope from the fact that's how people tend to respond. But I also do think that cultivating our communities better so that we're connected better and cultivating social resilience so that we're available to support one another as disasters come is absolutely necessary and will be the difference in the ways that we all experience the climate crisis. I mean, the American Climate Corps was not my idea, but I have been very lucky to be able to be involved in helping to evaluate it as it built out. The American Climate Corps builds on the legacy of Civilian Conservation Corps that came out of the New Deal, which was after the Great Depression in the United States, when the country was getting very close to there being a toppling of the government because there was such a crisis here. After the Depression, there were dust bowls. People were migrating all over the country to try to find work. And it was a really dark time in the United States. So part of the New Deal included establishing this Conservation Corps where young men could go to work and they'd earn a livable wage and they'd work on teams and they would help to build things in the United States. And some of them planted trees, so some of it was conservation. They helped with the railroads. They built all sorts of things with the Army Corps of Engineers. So there has been a call for a while now to build an American Climate Corps, which is building off of this legacy. The Biden administration finally announced the American Climate Corps last September during Climate Week. And one of the unfortunate things about the Climate Corps is that it builds on this amazing legacy, but it didn't receive much funding because the funding was originally going to be part of the Build Back Better Act, which was the climate-related policy that ended up being reformulated and repackaged as the Inflation Reduction Act. The Climate Corps was not funded as part of that. So it's coming out in a much more limited manner. But what it basically is doing is merging a number of pre-existing programs that are designed to help train young people to do work around climate change, broadly defined, across different agencies in the U.S. government, to train them so that they have experience working on addressing climate change in a variety of ways, and also have a pathway into doing green jobs, be they in the federal government or nonprofits or elsewhere in the government. And so the hope is that it will expand out to be thousands, if not more than thousands, tens of thousands of jobs. And that's the promise of the Climate Corps, but we have to see how it works out because as somebody who works with the federal government a lot, I know that the president can propose these amazing policies, but part of it is about congressional funding to see what's possible. So the big question is what kind of funding will come through to support it. This summer will be the first Climate Corps will hit the ground, and the first Corps will be focusing on addressing forest fires, which are driven by drought and exacerbated by climate change. And we've seen a lot of that out west. So there'll be some programs that are partnerships between the AmeriCorps federal program and the U.S. Forest Service to get young people trained to help to address forest fire and to limit forest fires. And there's been some interesting research recently about the fact that we don't really know how many people are losing lives because of extreme heat, right? Extreme events, climate change exacerbated events, which I call climate shocks in the book. We haven't been counting that. I think we will start counting it and we'll get a better sense of the trend. But there's no doubt that the numbers are going up, even though we aren't sure about the exact numbers globally. You had that estimate. I would just say that with regard to the amount of people we need in the streets, again, I'm very cautious about putting a number on it. What we do know is we need a lot more people pushing back against power, particularly given the way that fossil fuel interests are continuing to push, to greenwash, to try very hard to affect decision-making. I mean, there was an article that just came out today in the Washington Post about how the Trump administration is trying very hard to attract funds for supporting the campaign from oil companies with the promise that all regulations will be gone, right? And this shows us what the type of crossroads we're at, because it's not just the United States where some fossil fuel interests are pushing very hard. They're supporting elected officials and they're pushing for decision-making that reflects their interests, which is not in the interest of the planet. And it's certainly not in the interest of the general public, which is going to be facing these climate shocks that will come more frequently and with more severity with every incremental degree that we warm. So the movement right now on college campuses is a very interesting movement. In some ways, it's what social movement scholars like myself would call a moment of madness. And the reason that I call it that rather than a more traditional type of protest is that frequently protests and large-scale mobilizations are organized through groups that coordinate for a long period of time to develop and organize a mobilization that is like a big demonstration or an event. And they bring in people from all over to affect change. They have specific demands, et cetera, and so forth. In this moment, what we've seen is that there has been a big push by young people, particularly concern about what's going on with the war in Gaza and a lot of demands for there to be a ceasefire, which went unanswered. What happened is that the students on Columbia University's campus decided to start an encampment, which I should just say is a very common tactic on Columbia's campus. It's a common tactic on campuses all over the United States. What's unique about this moment is that the Columbia University administration, for a range of reasons, called in the New York City Police Department to clear the encampment very quickly. And they came in with force that was extremely aggressive for these peaceful, nonviolent activists who were engaging in civil disobedience. And as a result of that repression against the nonviolent protesters, first of all, more people came out the next day and there was a big mobilization on Columbia's campus. what we also saw encampments spring up across the United States. And I talk about this in the book, that it's very common that when people are engaging in civil disobedience, particularly nonviolent civil disobedience, what you would expect, and we have seen this when nonviolent activists are met with repression, what happens is it escalates the mobilization, and it can also create much more confrontational and even violent activism. What we saw on Columbia's campus in response to this, some of the activists occupied a building, and while they were not being violent to humans, they did destroy property and pulled out the furniture. It looked like they were preparing to have a bonfire, which is a standard tactic. And once again, riot police were called. So we've really seen the way that law enforcement has militarized in the United States. These are examples of it. The police response to a lot of these protests has been much more aggressive and much quicker than it was during the 1960s, where in most cases, National Guard and riot police were not called in until buildings were blown up. So we're seeing it happening much faster, but it does tell us about how climate activists will likely be facing repression as well. I mean, we see climate activists facing repression, certainly in the UK and other parts of Europe. I would just say that what we know today is that, first of all, we are all going to be experiencing climate change in our communities, and we may experience it through extreme weather. But what we also know is that when those types of events come, there are opportunities for people in communities to work together to build more solidarity across identities, orientations, and concerns. In fact, we're about to get storms right now because it's been extremely hot for May, just like it is around the world right now. And the best thing you can do is work with your community to start to help support people so that they can be ready for those kinds of shocks. In general, we know from research that makes stronger communities, better towns and villages, and better towns and villages make better countries because it makes us better citizens. So as you mentioned, this report in The Guardian, we can't stop it. We're here. The climate crisis is upon us. It's going to be a very long, hot summer. There's going to be a lot of protests, a lot of activism, a lot of people feeling cheated and threatened by the world and the way the world is going. And what we need to do is support one another and create opportunities both to train young people so they have ideas of how they can help make the world a better place and get jobs and think about and envision a life even with the climate crisis, because that's one of the things that is limiting some people in terms of envisioning a future. One of the things that's beautiful about cities is when done well, they require individuals to consume a lot less carbon than if you live in places like I live right outside Washington, D.C., but where I live, we just have a lot more space. There's much less public transit, and it makes a big difference in how much carbon we consume. I mean, my family, we put solar panels on our house, we use electric cars, but they still, it's just much harder. So what I would love to see is more cities that are embracing and encouraging public transit. I know Paris has done some really innovative things with regard to creating green space, creating opportunities for people to use bikes and other types of individual transportation options, as well as investing in public transit. The other thing that we can see that I think is really important is transitioning away from natural gas in terms of the way that we cook. So that's something that a lot of people are starting to focus on, as well as the way that we heat our houses and our apartments. And that's something that is infrastructural that's necessary to be built, particularly in cities. But I think that there's a lot of discussion about how cities of the future will transition and not use natural gas, which will be really valuable for the amount of carbon that's released from a city and the amount that's being consumed by the individuals. For young people, I think that it's really important to be honest and say that we're in for it's going to be a bit of a crazy ride, but we're in this together. And particularly we as adults, those of us who have been around for a while, we need to start thinking through how we can be responsible and teach responsibility to our children, and also teach our children how to be hopeful and understand how they can be part of the solution. Because it's going to take all of us. No matter where we are, what we're doing, it's going to take all of us working together to get to the other side of the climate crisis. And as unfair as it may seem, the future is up to us. So we have to make it what we want, to actualize a future that supports as many people as possible and that doesn't destroy the planet.
We hope you've enjoyed this program and listening to the highlights of this podcast. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast or learn more about environmental projects, click on the subscribe button. Thank you for listening.